Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We were just talking in our last segment about the crossroads between art and activism and the role of entertainers in advancing civil rights. And now we'll continue this conversation about civil rights with a close look at how the FBI launched a coordinated surveillance program against Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You may have heard the program referred to as COINTELPRO, but the tactics and ferocity of the investigation aren't common knowledge. As the civil rights movement got underway, J. Edgar Hoover, who had been the FBI's director since 1924, became convinced that King was a communist and that his activism was an attempt by the Communist Party to stir up discord. In response to whether the civil rights movement was a communist plot, Dr. King had this to say.
I would hope that the FBI would come out and say something that I think is much more significant, and that is that it is amazing that so few Negroes have turned to communism in the light of that desperate plight. I think it is one of the amazing developments of the 20th century, how loyal the Negro has remained to America in spite of his long night of oppression and discrimination.
Hoover did not see it that way. He feared King's growing power. He called him, quote, the most dangerous Negro to the future of the country. The FBI had King's phones wiretapped. Agents tailed him and took clandestine photos. And later they paid off some of his confidants to act as, quote, racial informants. They even sent Dr. King's letters, blackmailing him about extramarital affairs and suggesting that he end his own life. Armed with a tranche of newly released documents and freshly unearthed archival footage, a new documentary called MLK FBI from IFC Films looks at both the details the FBI tried to neutralize the civil rights movement and MLK, while explores the bigger themes of how black men are viewed and treated in America. As one reviewer said of the film, it is, quote, essential, infuriating viewing. MLK FBI, you can buy tickets to stream it tonight at the Cinematter Social Justice Film Festival, and it will be available to stream on other services starting tomorrow. It's directed by Sam Pollard, who joins me now. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Alison, how you been?
I'm doing great. Let's start with all these documents. Where did these documents come from? Where had they been?
Well, we got them through the Freedom of Information Act and just transcripts of the audio tapes that the FBI recorded of Dr. King. I mean, some of them were heavily redacted, but we were able to still pull out some of the things that we use in the film. And my producer, Bennett Dean, did some a tremendous amount of legwork to get the material that we needed to help tell and shape the story.
You know, after you read them, what impact did that have on the way you made this film?
Well, you know, the impact that it had was simply this, that it just amazes me how far the FBI would go to discredit and destroy Dr. King's reputation. I mean, I think it's one thing for them to get signed off by Bobby Kennedy to wiretap him because of this, their thought that he might be flirting with communism because of his relationship with Stanley Levinson. But it's another thing to go to the links that they went to where they even create a letter basically saying to Dr. King, you know who you are, we know what you've done, you're a terrible human being, and intimating that he should maybe kill himself. And then on top of that, putting together an audio tape that's supposed to be Dr. King in a relationship with another woman they sent to his wife, Coretta Scott King. That's pretty, I think that's pretty disgusting on the part of Hoover and the FBI. I mean, and the other thing that sort of amazes me too, and you know, I grew up during this time, that the idea that they saw this man who was a nonviolent activist whose goal was to basically, through nonviolent methods and means, try to get America to realize that we, as black people, should be a part of the mainstream, we should be integrated, that the years of segregation should be abolished, we should be able to vote, we should be able to go and live any place we want to live, that he was looked at as a radical, that he was looked at as a dangerous man. In retrospect, you say, what? Right. I mean, they really thought he was dangerous? Obviously they did. I mean, because all of a sudden, people like Hoover and others were seeing a black man stand up and say, we want to be counted. And excuse me. Mm-hmm. And the idea that African-Americans who had been basically, as you know, in the shadows of America for so many years, in the mainstream, are now saying we want to be front and center. That was obviously frightening to people. I mean, and I think a telling point is the three moments in the film itself, when the white man on the street says to a reporter, Hoover says King is terrible, but I think he's 10 times worse. And then this other person, this white woman, says, I don't like him because he's uppity. And then you have this news show where King is on, and the lady, she's a journalist, I imagine, she asked Dr. King, don't you feel the peaceful protests are causing the riots in the city? And when I first heard that, and then I'm thinking about the same attitude that people have to the Black Lives Matter movement that you heard over the summer. You know, you say, boy, has America learned any lessons? And then she's going to ask King, don't you feel your people are moving too fast? I mean, is that ludicrous for her to ask a question like that? You know, where we had to sit in the back of the bus, we couldn't go into a restaurant. There was restaurants, you know, you couldn't drink at a water fountain with white people, colored only, bathrooms. This is like, what? Is this lady, where is she from?
Well, prior to that quote, the most dangerous Negro to the future of this country, prior to that, how was the FBI even thinking about the civil rights movement?
They saw the civil rights movement as a radical movement that was going to upend this notion of American democracy. You know, it's like, part of me is angry about it when I think about it, but the idea that you want America to stay the way it is, where the only people that you're supposed to recognize are those people who are white, is like amazing to me. I was watching a movie, Allison, the other night, an old movie from 1942 with Alan Ladd, and he has a scene with this young woman, Benita Granville, and he's telling her, I don't want you associating with these low-life criminal types. And she says to him, you can't tell me what to do, because, and this is a term that they used to use back in the 40s and the 30s and the 40s. She says, you can't tell me what to do because I'm free, white, and 21. You know, I'm free, white, and 21. So I could do anything I want to do. You know, and so for J. Edgar Hoover and others, when they see black people say, we want to free and black and do what we want to do, it was like, whoa. No, hold up. Nope, that's too much. You guys are causing problems. I mean, amazing. Amazing when you think about the hypocrisy in America.
My guest is Sam Pollard, and we're talking about his new film, MLK/FBI. So the FBI starts to become interested in Stanley Levinson. He's a white Jewish lawyer, a friend, a confidant of Dr. King's. What role does Levinson play in the FBI becoming more and more interested in Dr. King?
Because he had been associated with these brothers who had been members of the Communist Party from the 40s, 30s, and 40s and 50s. And they were very close until he decided to lead the Communist Party. So the FBI had been monitoring those brothers, and then they knew about Levinson. So when Levinson was introduced to Dr. King, immediately the FBI's antenna went up and said, uh-oh, you know, he's flirting with the Communist Party, and they may be trying to co-opt him. You know, so that's why they basically started to wiretap King. Now, the thing that King did, which is, you know, kind of deceitful on his part, when he's confronted by JFK and Bobby Kennedy about his relationship with Levinson and other members who had been in the Communist Party, like Brian Rustin and others, he's told to disassociate himself, because this is right before the March in Washington. Disassociate yourself from these other people, because it's gonna be a stain on the civil rights movement. I mean, which is kind of, it's fascinating to me, because John Kennedy had to be pulled. He didn't all of a sudden say, I'm completely supportive. He had to be pulled into the movement, you know, because he knew that that was the right thing to do. But King said to these two gentlemen that he was going to disassociate himself from Stanley Levinson, but in actuality, he never did. He did from others, you know, but he didn't do it from Stanley Levinson, because he trusted Levinson. Levinson helped him with speeches and stuff. They became very close confidants, you know, at that time.
I want to play a clip from the film of J. Edgar Hoover crediting or kind of blaming the Communist Party for the rise of the civil rights movement. Let's take a listen.
We are all familiar with the fact that the communists have been agitating racial problems, racial disunity in our nation for the last several years. That's the reason that you've seen racial agitators like Martin Luther King rise on the scene and get all kinds of national publicity. This was intended. They would like nothing more than to see a civil war in the 1960s in the United States.
Sam, this is so crazy because it sounds like things that could be said in the past 6 months about Antifa and Black Lives Matter. Why is this narrative so persistent?
It's so persistent because America is such a hypocritical nation, and they don't want to deal with the fact that, you know, that for hundreds of years, white people have had their boots on the necks of black people, and systemic racism is so pervasive in this country, you know, that no one seems to figure out how they need to shake it. They need to come to a reckoning and understand that they got to be able to flip the switch. You know, it's amazing to hear the same kind of dialogue in the past 6 months that we heard in the 60s. It's amazing, you know. I mean, and when you that clip you just played, he says causing racial problems. The country had lots of racial problems, you know, before the Communist Party. But, you know, the fact that they wanted black people to be docile, don't make waves, you know, just get along. Stay in your place. Everything will be all right. That's what they wanted. That's what America wanted, you know. And it's sad. It's really sad.
I want to talk a little bit.
And Allison,
continue.
It clarifies for me as a young man when my father and my uncles all left Mississippi, mm-hmm. you know, because they knew that life down there, they would not survive staying in Mississippi as young black men.
I want to ask about some of the bugging that went on. The FBI had bugged the home of Clarence Jones, an advisor to Dr. King, and that's how they learned about the non-monogamous private affairs. And the documentary highlights the fact that these accusations against Dr. King, I mean, the language is incredibly difficult to talk about. They say he's a pervert and he's unfit for moral leadership. And, you know, it's a narrative that's very resonant with very old and very racist ideas that black men are sexually violent. How is the FBI going to weaponize this information?
Well, the strategy was that when they got this information, they could then pass it on to the press, you know, the New York Times, all the different newspapers, the magazines, and that the press would grab onto it and print it and exploit it, and the world would know, look, see how horrific Dr. King is, this man of the cloth, this man who's a menace to the Ebenezer Baptist Church. You know, how can he be leading a movement when he has such a tawdry life? But what Hoover didn't reckon with was the fact that the press back in the 60s didn't take on personal lives of people. They stayed away from it. They knew about these things, but they didn't take it on. They didn't use it, you know, and put it in the papers, put it in the magazines. I mean, not like we do today. But the thing that I say today is that even though the press will dig into someone's personal life and you see how scandalous or perverse someone's life is, I'm not sure how it sticks. I mean, look at all the stuff that came out about Trump before he got elected mm-hmm. and since he's been in office, and none of it sticks. None of it seems to stick. So I'm not sure if the press was doing what they did today back then, it probably would have stick with Dr. King because he's a black man, but it didn't stick. That's why, you know, Hoover was so upset. I mean, that's why he ended up saying that thing about King in 64. He was the most notorious liar, which then, you know, forced King to have a sit down with J. Edgar Hoover, where, and as you heard in the film, Andy Young said Hoover did most of the talking.
Mm. Yeah. Why was it so personal for Hoover? That is something that I sort of picked up from the whole film that just felt extremely personal.
I think it was personal for Hoover because he grew up in a time in America where black people were supposed to know their place, mm-hmm. you know, and all of a sudden, here's one man who's ascended to, you know, a certain level where people around the country and then around the world are really paying attention to him. And as far as Hoover could see, and like a lot of people probably thought, Dr. King had forgot his place. You know, he wasn't going to be like how we were represented when we go back and watch those old movies in the 30s and 40s, you know. He wasn't going to be like Willie Best. He wasn't going to be like Mantan Moreland. He wasn't going to be like Stepan Fetchit. He wasn't going to be like Butterfly McQueen, where, you know, they could be made fun of. They would be afraid of their own shadow, you know. You know, they were just going to be there to be a butler or your maid or your house person or take care of your children and stuff. They weren't going to make waves. And all of a sudden, here's a man saying, we are making waves. That had to be personal to him and other many, many, many white people who grew up in a time when America was a different place, where if you were black, you got back.
Mm-hmm. What came of that face-to-face meeting, that meeting after Hoover called King the most notorious liar?
From what Andy Young said when we interviewed him, not much. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think Hoover apologized. I think King listened. Andy Young was there. They listened to Hoover, and they might have said, this is not right what you're saying. The FBI, what's the FBI been doing for black people? You know, what about when Cheney, Sherman, and Goodman were killed? I mean, what is the FBI really doing for these civil rights, you know, activists who are being killed? But I don't think anything really came out of it that was substantial. You know, you didn't see Hoover, you know, issue an apology.
There is one point in the film where there's a document that flashes on screen for just a few seconds, and there's a section that titled that just says, King emotionally upset. What was he worried about?
I think, here's my take, and you know, and who knows if it's factual from what I'm going to say to you. I think King, like a lot of us, he had a lot of balls in the air. Here he was, the leader of the civil rights movement, trying to juggle how to deal with breaking the back of segregation in all these cities. Here's a man who's dealing with the fact that he's being monitored by the man who's the director of the FBI, who's more popular than him, as you realize from that poll that was taken. Here's a man, you know, who's trying to keep his forces together as they go from city to city. Here's a man who's probably astounded that he got the Nobel Peace Prize in 64. Here's a man who by 67 says, you know, it's not just about the civil rights movement. It's about understanding. It's about human rights. It's also about the fact that he felt very strongly after he read that Ramparts magazine and saw those pictures in Ramparts about the fact that America can be in Vietnam, but knowing full well by coming out at the, you know, with his speech at Riverside Church in 67, coming out against Vietnam, he was going to destroy the relationship he had with the Johnson administration, who was so supportive of the civil rights movement, you know, with the passing of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. He was going to destroy that relationship. And so, and then he's going to try to create the Poor People's Campaign, and then he's asked to come to Memphis. This man was juggling and doing a lot, mm-hmm. you know. So to be emotionally upset about things, it sounds completely correct and accurate, because he was, you know, because, I mean, there's so much he had to confront every day.
Dr. King sort of gets pressured by LBJ's Democratic allies into being quiet about the Vietnam War for a time. And I want to play a clip from your film, MLK FBI, of Pulitzer Prize-winning King biographer David Garrow explaining how that moral quandary played out for King.
Nonviolence for King was not simply a civil rights protest tactic. King believed that nonviolence was a Christian ethic that should be applied around the world, not just by black demonstrators.
Sam, how did the war in Vietnam square with the civil rights movement in his mind?
I think what Dr. King understood was that, you know, Vietnam was a place where America really shouldn't have been. I mean, it was about this, again, this notion that we were going to stop the spread of communism, you know. And it really, it's really a sign of American imperialism. And basically, I think that King really connected the fact that this notion of American imperialism, a sense of, you know, controlling other people's destinies, was something he saw in America on a daily basis. And that's what motivated him to want to break down the barriers of segregation, you know. So it was part and parcel of his sense of humanity, as Garrett was really saying, you know, that if you're going to fight for the rights of people in this country, you need to be able to fight for the rights of people around the world, you know. And America was basically doing something that was going against what he felt, you know, both philosophically and from a religious perspective, that they should not have been doing.
You know, we have to acknowledge this film is coming out at a time when the FBI is in the spotlight over failures last week when the far-right extremists stormed the Capitol and tried to interrupt the democratic process and failed. You spent so much time going over material from what's considered to be the darkest chapter in the Bureau's history. How did that affect your impression of what happened in the past week?
Well, here's my take, Allison. When Comey says that, my reaction is, that's his perspective. You know, I'm cynical enough to believe that there's probably darker chapters in the history of the FBI that hasn't been revealed. Another thing that we should take away from what happened last week, the fact that the FBI, who probably knew a lot of the stuff that was going to happen last week, didn't really step up, goes back to what happened after Dr. King was assassinated. Here they are, you know, monitoring King 24/7. You know, as Chuck Knox says in the film, every time the FBI heard about King going to another city, it was all hands on deck. That means they had agents traveling to those places where King was going to go with his associates. They had agents in the hotels, talking to managers, bugging rooms, setting up tape recording. How were they not privy and knowing that there were possible assassinations, there was going to be a possible assassination attempt on Dr. King's life? And then, basically, after King is assassinated, the FBI, like last week now, had to be sort of pushed to really dig into finding out, you know, supposedly who was the person who assassinated King, James Earl Ray. I mean, you know, there's some stuff that needs to be looked into that in terms of what the FBI does and what they won't do until they are sort of, you know, put their feet up, put to the fire. The other thing that's kind of interesting, though, Allison, is that those of us who are liberal and to the left in the last 4 years, Donald J. Trump's, you know, denigration of the FBI has been so intense that some of us said maybe the FBI isn't so bad.
The name of the film is MLK, FBI. You can buy tickets to stream it tonight at the Cinematters Social Justice Film Festival. It will be available to stream on other services starting tomorrow. My guest has been its director, Sam Pollard. Sam, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Good talking to you. Be good.